Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch, and it's going to be a long week. We can tell that already. Will Flanagan, Jim Dalkey are in the studio from Chicago. You know, I was trying to get into right away this idea of Bartman being given a ring. Good for the Cubs. Good for him for accepting it. And maybe now it's over.
That poor guy. All I do is just feel really sorry for Steve Bartman. But I guess this is a happy ending for him. I don't know how he feels
maybe,
about all this.
I don't know. I feel like he'd probably trade the ring for the normalcy of his life was, what, 15 years ago?
I don't know if that's true enough, because that was he made a really bad decision then, but I hope he wouldn't compound it by throwing the ring back.
Did he
now
get one of the player rings that has all the real diamonds in it, or is he one of these kind of field supervisor kind of rings?
So right away, bring the dark cloud into it. Look, he got a ring. The Cubs gave him a ring. All right, Dalkey and Flanagan are here from Chicago Inno, and they come by most Mondays. As I said a little bit earlier, we're going to talk to the head of the Federal Bar Association, Judge Michael Newman, will be here. Maria Vathis as well, who is the treasurer, and talk about the federal judiciary and arguing before the federal bench. I'm interested in whether it's changed. Why would it be? But I just wonder if you can, over a career, see how things have changed. I don't know. One of the reasons I love talking to the Inno boys is because they sort of confront me with things that I had never considered, things that are happening and created in Chicago. And there's this one here now. So I'm reading the story that 40% of the world's population relies on solid fuel for cooking. So wood fires, right? Dung fires or coal fires or things like that. And now there's a company out of Chicago or connected to Chicago that might be able to harness solar energy for an oven?
Exactly. This is a University of Illinois startup, and they have, I think, maybe my favorite startup name of any company that we've covered, Sun Buckets.
Right.
So basically what they are doing is creating a solar-powered cooking device, so you don't need a fire. This is not fuel that you typically need to use to kind of cook your food. It's powered by the sun.
Is it like a giant magnifying glass you put over the roast beef or something? Right.
Kind of.
Is it? How does it work?
It almost looks like a big satellite that is sitting on top of a bucket. The solar powered lens is generating and getting a ton of heat, and it is cooking this bucket that is kind of insulated in a way that it basically turns the interior into an oven that can cook food right away, or can hold this heat for up to 6 hours, and the outside is still safe to touch. So it's a really kind of inventive device. And to your point, you think about it, I think it's very easy to look at these devices and be like, oh, that's a cool thing for camping or for, you know, going to music festival. And you realize, like, yeah, 40% of the world really needs this. And what's neat is this came from a project that was inspired by a professor at U of I, his work with their Engineers Without Borders student chapters, kind of seeing this problem firsthand. And again, we've talked about these solutions and companies all the time. So these are my favorite startup stories, the ones where you see this problem firsthand and you innovate around it. This wasn't someone looking at margins or
right,
billion opportunity. It was, wow, this is a problem. Here's how I fix it.
Where are they now? What do they do with this? They're still creating
early
it,
stages
sort of,
still. Yeah. So yeah, they've gone around and kind of done the startup accelerator sort of venture competition kind of game right now, kind of early days of still getting funding and kind of figure out how to commercialize this. So still in the early days, you're not going to see the Sun Bucket at Target just yet, but we'll see.
It could be world changing. I mean, it's an idea that could be world-changing.
Yeah,
right?
and it's also a little further beyond idea stages. It's being used in field trials in the Navajo Nation in Southwest U.S. It's won funding of $100,000 from the Ocean Exchange Competition in Savannah and the Clean Energy Trust. So it's moving.
Of course, the problem is you're going to go if there's a need. And the idea is that there's pollution and indoor air pollution, which results in hundreds of thousands of premature deaths every year, right, in these homes. But you would have to go to these cultures and convince them, you know, who have been cooking over fires for centuries to start eating Swanson pot pies that you would put in the Sun Bucket or something. You're right. They'd have to completely almost change their way of eating.
Yeah, but it's not just this is a thing that cooks pre-made meals. This is basically a sun-powered oven. It's a sun-powered microwave. The issue is, you know, and this isn't the first sun-powered cooking device. The issue with anything solar-powered is, Steve, you and I are ready to eat a nice meal tonight, and it's cloudy. That is a problem that you're really never going to get around, is by when you rely on the sun to cook your food.
Except this helps, right? Because this you can preheat in a way where you can do it early and it holds the heat for a while.
Exactly. And it does work in direct and indirect sunlight too. So, I mean, there is some functionality there too. But yeah, like back to your point, I mean, it's changing the way people think about cooking. We're seeing a lot of these devices, right? Like Tovala, the other Chicago startup, is sort of changing the way you think about your microwave and to kind of give you prepared food that gives you a better quality taste.
We're going to take a break here, but give me a minute on Braintree. Jim, you wrote a story about them, and I had no idea. I've worked with Braintree.
Yeah, Braintree is a Chicago startup, launched 2007, was acquired by PayPal for $800 million, really was one of the poster children of successful Chicago tech companies, and they just announced last week that they are now processing over a billion payment transactions per quarter.
Wow.
Really, really transformative technology kind of coming out of a Chicago startup. They kind of power the payment processing behind a lot of the apps you use. So when you take an Uber, Braintree is sort of working behind the scenes to facilitate that payment transaction. So you're using Braintree a lot.
But it's just not really an upfront company that we know a lot about.
Exactly. They're really one of these B2B success stories that you see in Chicago. And it's, you know, in Chicago, we talk about, you know, should a startup be acquired or sort of stand alone? And Braintree is the kind of example where it was acquired and it was not a bummer because they are still able to scale and be really successful as a company.
Jim Dahlke, Will Flanagan here as well from Chicago Inn. We're going to take a quick break and come back and talk about plastics. Will Flanagan, the general manager of Chicago Inno, is here. Jim Dahlke, who is a reporter for Chicago Inno as well. They come by most Mondays and we talk about what's new in sort of the world of innovation and tech in Chicago. And they're one of the favorite parts of my week. So it's great to see you guys. I love when you come in. You're both nodding, which shows you have no experience yet in radio. You've been doing this for over a year.
Flattery makes us uncomfortable.
All right, let's talk plastics because, changing the way people cook around the world is one thing. This idea of finding a way to recycle hard-to-recycle plastics could be another game changer as well.
Exactly. So, yeah, last week on the site we wrote about PureCycle Technologies, and they really, what they've done is invented a way to recycle this plastic polypropylene that has been undone before. So no one's been able to recycle this plastic, and it is everywhere. It's one of the most common plastics in the world.
I mean, I didn't realize that. We think of recycling plastics, but there's a huge chunk of plastics that we can't
Basically, polypropylene is it's very difficult to recycle because when you recycle it, when you grind it up and reuse it, it comes with this like sort of odor and it's all gray.
Right.
And it's very difficult for big product companies to reuse these. If the top of your like Tide detergent is polypropylene, it comes in a lot of the inside of vehicles. So it's like used everywhere. And basically, PureCycle Technologies has found a way to kind of divert that away from oceans and landfills and recycle it really for the very first time.
And what's cool about this, it's a portfolio company of Aventure, which was a new firm launched last year from an ex-Walgreens CEO, Gregory Wasson. And what they're doing is they're, obviously this guy is familiar with how much money is spent in R&D in these gigantic firms. And what they're doing is this technology was started at P&G and P&G's R&D lab. And you realize there's so much of this innovation and research and development that is just sitting in these Fortune 100 buildings and IP. And what they're doing is they're empowering these companies to take this IP and spin it out into new companies.
Wow. Okay. So that was my question. So I didn't quite understand that. It came out of Procter & Gamble, but Wasson's company or Wasson's funding then allowed them to fish it out of P&G and develop it separately?
Exactly. P&G, it's very difficult for large enterprises to really sort of narrow in on these sort of disruptive new technologies and really focus in on how to bring that to the market. And so what Inventure is able to do is work with a company like P&G, spin out their technology that was invented by a chemist within the company, build a totally separate startup that offers the product back to P&G and to everywhere.
Wow.
They're going to commercialize it eventually by 2020.
So that's a great story.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to kind of see what Inventure does, which is Chicago-based, next. I mean, they're kind of really focused with P&G, but they're hoping in the next several years to kind of have 5 to 8 different startups like PureCycle that's really tackling big issues with some really disruptive tech.
All right, so there's that. Airbnb, was it a year ago that the city passed its ordinance that allowed them to sort of or required them to collect taxes, right? About a year ago?
Yeah, so we actually had an event a couple months ago called Travel Inno where we had someone from Airbnb there talk about kind of Midwest policy. And he was saying, like, the country and the world is really watching what's happening in Chicago. Chicago and Airbnb, like many cities across the country, is really trying to figure out, hey, is this good for our hotel industry? Is this good for our city? How much do we need to regulate? How hard do we need to play a ball?
As I remember with Airbnb, they kind of took a different tact, right? They didn't have sort of their claws out right away.
So that's exactly right. So Uber, for example, was famous for they expanded by just being like, we're here, sorry, get used to it. Like that's kind of the Uber model, whereas Airbnb was very much, we're here to play nice. What's the problem? How can we fix this? And one of the things that I think was really innovative and interesting was this adjustment to the ordinance that generated $2.8 million in taxes last year to help Chicago's homeless. So I think Airbnb has been an interesting model of like, yes, we're disruptive, but we're trying to be mindful of the industries and the cities that we're quote unquote disrupting. And one of the reasons behind this kind of policy, the nature of it, is because when we were talking to the gentleman with Airbnb, he was saying like when Uber comes in, Uber is disrupting taxis. People don't like have a great relationship with taxis. Right. People don't mind hotels. So if they're going to come in like jerks and be like, hey, we're here to take your hotel, people are like, well, I kind of like hotels. So they realized they had to be nice, play ball. And Chicago is one of the cities where there's a lot of these regulations.
And this little homeless tax thing worked so well here, right, that it's expanding.
Yeah, other cities like New Orleans are kind of taking a similar look at this and seeing how can they sort of tackle the affordable housing issue with a tax on a service like Airbnb.
We got time for one more, I think. And there's a story about a company called Retail, T-A-L-E. And it's old-fashioned coupons,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I mean, digitizing coupons.
Have they not heard about Amazon Prime Day? What's going on?
I know, but what's really cool about retail or interesting about retail, it's location-based. So you're walking around, you walk by a Target, a Walgreens, a Best Buy, your phone buzzes, hey, there's 20% inside. So they're taking that kind of the benefits of online e-commerce and using it to incentivize brick-and-mortar purchases. What I think's cool about the retail story is, Jim, in the earlier segment, we were talking about Chicago being this this mecca of B2B tech and software and innovation. And this is a B2C company that is doing 26 million users a month. That's a big number for a shopping app to be built in Chicago.
So I guess the idea is that, well, but you could be sitting at home and scroll through the coupons that they're offering too, right?
100%. That's available. So you can look at the inventory, but where they get a lot of where they work with the brands is because you can be walking around, you have your location services turned on your phone, and bzz, hey, 20% off Nikes.
Yeah, and it's a great idea.
Only 30. I only shop after 30.
But I don't know, though, that I'd always want to be like walking around and have my phone constantly buzz when like there's 20% off right. Detergent. You know what I mean? But I think you'd have to kind of have some functionality with like determining when you get promotions and stuff like that. But at the same time, you know, it's this sort of passive alert to your phone like, hey, when you go to the store, be sure to pick up this because it's on sale.
But it is interesting. In a way, they are repainting the blacksmith shop. I mean, they even say in the article, I don't know if it's a CEO or who said it, but he's like, well, we think people still like to go into stores and shop. So they're kind of dressing up they're putting a new costume on a very old idea.
Totally. And that's why online grocery is still only a sliver of the whole market. I mean, most people still shop for their bananas in the grocery store.
Yeah.
And that's not going to end quite yet.
Amazon may very well destroy brick and mortar. It's not happening overnight. I think the narrative that e-commerce has destroyed retail is a little overblown. Like, it's eaten a little bit of its lunch, but it's still a gigantic industry in retail. The app, the Chicago app, is helping it drive more users.
Will Flanagan, Jim Dahlke, Chicago Inno. People can read a lot more about this at chicagoinno.com. Thanks for coming by, guys.
Thanks, Steve.
Beautiful Monday afternoon along Michigan Avenue in the Allstate Showcase Studio. And, well, in the studio, we have a couple of guests here. Judge Michael Newman, who is the president of the Federal Bar Association, and Maria Vathis, who is the treasurer Right? Welcome to both of you.
Thank you, Steve. Great to be here.
Now, Michael's been on before. Maria, this is your first time, so it I think it's okay, right?
Absolutely. Everyone's friendly. I'm very proud of Maria, delighted that she's here. She's going to be the national president in just a little bit more than a year. She's works at the Brian Kay firm in Chicago, and I just thought, Steve, you're so kind to have her on. She's here locally in Chicago, going to be national president. What a great tribute to Chicago.
Well, we like to have the power located in Chicago and not Southern Ohio, where it's been for the past year.
Understood.
So, Michael, you're giving up. Your term ends next
month.
My
term ends at the end of September, and I will be passing the baton to Kip Boland, who's going to be the incoming national president from the Thompson Hine firm in Cleveland.
And then the year after that, it's Maria. So at any time during the next year, can Maria back out?
It might be too late for that
now. I think it's too late. We have our hooks into her pretty well.
Well, one of the things when we talked before, we discussed civics and your civic outreach and the idea of, we just talked about what it means to be a magistrate.
Absolutely,
because
absolutely.
You know, that's your job, and a lot of people don't understand it. You helped with that. But reaching out to young people to teach them about the federal judiciary, that was one of your goals over the past year. How did you do?
So I think we've had great success, Steve. Thanks for asking. We've reached out to 10,000 kids around the country.
Wow.
Who've met with a federal judge, mostly in federal courtrooms, but in many instances. In a good way.
Right.
In a good way. To expose them to the workings of the federal courts, show them what a courtroom looks like, explain the criminal process, the civil process, explain mediation, and in areas that are more rural, judges have actually gotten in their car and driven to where the kids are. That's how much of a passion the judges have for this program to work and be
so
successful.
So who gets more out of it, you think, the kids or the judges?
That's a great question. I think it's 50-50. In my experience, I think the judges, it renews for them the reason why they went to law school in the first place. And to get to talk about the Constitution to young people, there's nothing more energizing as a judge than that. And I think if I can put myself in the perspective of the young people, what they've told me, to see a courtroom, to meet a judge. I mean, when I was a kid, I never met a judge before. To have that experience and to actually get questions like, okay, judge, what do you do if you have a conflict? Well, the answer is you recuse yourself, of course, right? But to ask a federal judge questions like that,
right.
How do you deal with these complicated legal questions? To talk about that, it's great.
Maria, let the record show that Michael brought up recusal first, so we might have to revisit that a little later. That was not my doing. So when you see what he's done and you prepare for your leadership, Maria, are you in search of sort of a central theme, or how does it work when your tenure at the Federal Bar Association?
Judge Newman has been a phenomenal leader, and I'd love to continue all of the civics initiatives that he's created and to, you know, just further his efforts, because it has just been amazing and an inspiration for everybody who's participated, for the students, and I plan to continue that, and maybe I'll have my own twist, but it's in the works.
So what's the mood of the people? Because you guys represent the lawyers who argue before the judges as well as the judges, right?
In the federal
system,
correct.
Yeah, in the federal system. And it just seems to me that the federal judiciary, and not the work really being done in it maybe, but the talk about it has become so political, so politicized, demeaning really, to the process. And I just wonder what you guys make of that and what you're seeing on the bench and elsewhere because of it.
Well, I'll tell you, on my own behalf, I've gone around the country this year meeting federal judges to promote the FBA and to promote this National Civics Initiative, which, by the way, we're doing in conjunction with the Administrative Office of the U.S. Courts in Washington. The judges that I've met and the judges that I have known for years are hardworking, loyal. They care about the Constitution. Many of them are there till 8 o'clock at night. They take their job very, very seriously, as I do. They feel very honored and privileged that they're the person who gets to decide these very important cases, these very important disputes. The judges that I know care very, very much about the Constitution, and they work really, really hard.
But do they feel a little under attack?
I probably would be the wrong person to answer that as a judge myself. Maria, I will pass the baton to you.
I hope not, because from what I've seen, our federal judges work so hard, and they try their hardest to be fair. It's really a tough job, and we're so lucky here in Chicago, where I've had the most experience, because our federal bench here is amazing.
Okay, so I'm going to ask a question that neither of you will be comfortable with. Michael probably have a better reason to dodge it than Maria. But when you see a case, not that you're on a case, maybe you're just reading about a case peripherally, and you see it, and then you see the judge it's going to be assigned to, do you get a feeling for how it's going to go, how the outcome will be? And that's not an indictment of anything. I'm just wondering, you know, I think from a distance we tend to think of it as sort of a singular event, but it's not. It's a, different judges see things differently.
I'll just jump in briefly, but I will turn over to Maria. In my experience, most judges in the federal system follow the law. They follow it carefully. They follow it closely. And that's what judges do, and that's my constitutional oath. That's the oath that I took to do, and that's what I do every day.
And I would agree with that, but every judge has their own rules, too, so that is always a factor that we'll look into when a case is assigned.
I mean, I haven't covered the federal courts in a long time, but I just knew there were tough judges. There were judges you can get away with things with and things like that, right? Okay, good. So
so can I put in a quick plug for a really good
not
judge?
Not until I ask you. No. Okay, go ahead. Go ahead.
Chief Judge Castillo here in Chicago has the program, which I think is fantastic, where lawyers who volunteer their time and effort to help pro se litigants, they honor them here in the federal courthouse. It's done once a year. It's a fantastic program. I don't think it's replicated in many federal courthouses around the country. I had the honor of speaking at this program. It's done in May. In conjunction with Law Day, I was there, you know, in May to here back in Chicago for the program. It's fantastic, Steve. And more courts around the country are beginning to honor and replicate what's happening in Chicago and honor lawyers who are volunteering their time and effort to help the court.
Why is it that Judge Castillo did it and others aren't?
I think they're just way ahead of the curve here in Chicago, to their credit, and it's a fantastic program. And since I participated, I've now gone a little bit around the country and telling other judges and other courts, wow, we should be replicating what they're doing in Chicago.
I do want to go back and ask one other question, and it's a serious one. It's the Ninth Circuit, right? That's the liberal one out on the West Coast. So how is it? Were you just rolling your eyes before I finished my question?
I'm turning it over to Maria. I'm not letting get anything political or
no. And I don't mean it to be political, but this is a serious question. So you know, each new president assigns members to the judiciary or to the appellate courts, right? That's what happens. So you have a Republican president now. You had a Republican president 8 years ago. How is it that with either party selecting members for that court, that it can still be known, and maybe there's a predominantly conservative one too, I'm less aware of. How is it that it doesn't change, that it stays that way? Do you understand the question?
I think so. I you know, there's still going to be judges remaining from the other affiliated party. So
sure.
I think that that's how it really balances out is, you know, it will balance out because people will get appointed from different parties and people will remain on the bench.
But it seems as no matter who appoints there, that And I don't know if it just is the overwhelming population there or, you know, why it is that it always tends to go left. Maybe it's an unanswerable question. I don't mean to put anyone on the spot.
It might be for me, but, you know, I'm sure everybody has a theory.
As the incoming soon-to-be president of the Federal Bar Association. Tell me quickly, you got a boot camp going on.
We do. So it's at BYU Law School out in Utah. It starts today. It runs this whole week. It's the first residential court camp in the United States. What's court camp? It's an opportunity for young people to come and learn about the federal courts and learn about civics. And at BYU, literally the first one ever in the country to bring kids into a law school, have them stay overnight, meet federal judges. This coming Wednesday, they're going to go to the federal courthouse in Salt Lake City. It's never been done before. It's sponsored by the Federal Bar Association, the district court, the federal court out in Utah, and BYU Law School, and we're really proud of it.
Michael Newman is the president of the Federal Bar Association. Maria Vathis is the treasurer and will be president in a year or so. Thanks both of
you
for coming in.
Great honor to be on the show. We're very grateful.
Michael, you're welcome to come back even after the title's gone, but Maria especially when you've got it. We'd love to have you back.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
Very kind of you. Thank you.
Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thanks very much for tuning in. I appreciate that. And hope you'll follow me on Twitter at Steve Bertrand. Also on Facebook, Steve Bertrand. There's a public page there. Follow along. Randy Schaefer is in the studio. She's a digital editor for the Chicago Tribune. Comes by on most Mondays to talk about what's new in social media. Randy, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Well, hello.
Well, hello. All right. So we have talked about influencers, whether it's Instagram or whatever, right, and their import and how sometimes they're making things up and how they make money and blah, blah, blah. And now I read this new story about pods and how that might be impacting the influencers or how the influencers might be getting more money than they should. Or explain for me what these pods are.
Yeah, so when Instagram first debuted...
Slowly, by the way, because
slowly,
clearly you can tell it's above my head here.
When Instagram first debuted its algorithm several odd months ago, a lot of influencers started noticing that their reach was kind of dwindling off and a lot of people weren't seeing their content so much anymore. So they figured out that in order to kind of game the algorithm, they had to generate a large initial amount of interest on their post. And then Instagram's algorithm sees, wow, you know, 30 people like this post in a minute. It must be a super awesome post. So we're going to throw it in the feeds of everybody that follows this person. And we're even going to put it on the Explore page. So these influencers have figured this out. And so they form these so-called comment pods.
And maybe I'm a little ahead of most people, but so the influencers are people who they make money being followed, right?
Yeah. Brands work with these influencers. They'll have
some of them. Sometimes they're celebrities. Sometimes they're just YouTube stars.
The Kardashians or even just Joe Schmo down the street that's got 30,000 Twitter followers feels like making a buck selling motor oil or who knows.
Right. Okay. And so they figured out a way to say, hey, to get for the algorithm to kick in, for more eyes to get on my post, I need to have more people see my post right away to sort of create a burst.
Exactly.
And these pods help create the burst.
Yeah, so Instagram will allow up to 30 people on a message. So what these pods are is just these Instagram messages of 30 people saying, hey, I posted, go like and comment on my post. And they'll go back and forth. And so you'll post. Within 5 minutes, you'll have 30 likes, 30 comments on your post. And it's kind of unfair because it makes these influencers seem like they have a wider net than they actually have. So if a brand wants to work with an influencer, they're saying, wow, 30 people genuinely care what this person has to say. Well, they're not 30 potential customers.
Right.
They're 30 of these influencers'
friends. They're 30 buddies.
Yeah.
In a way.
Yeah.
And so your money might be badly spent if you're because it's an inflated number.
Exactly.
But it also seems like it's an accelerant that they're putting on a message. If that accelerant then is getting the brand's image to a lot more people, why wouldn't that be in the brand's interest?
Well, because it doesn't necessarily target the correct audience for the brand.
I see. Okay. And so what is Instagram doing about this?
So far, nothing that I've heard of.
And so the pods are growing?
The pods are growing. I keep seeing more and more of them on my Explore page. I keep hiding them because I can kind of tell when people do this. You tend to see the same friends liking each other's posts, especially if you follow multiple people from the same kind of cohort.
So it's widespread?
It is, yeah. There's an entire, actually, Reddit subreddit dedicated to Instagram and forming pods, and there are Facebook groups of forming pods.
Wow.
And it's kind of off Instagram and actually all over the internet.
So I guess the impetus to do something about it for Instagram would be if the brand stopped buying. Well, no, do they have any skin in it at all? Because they're not losing advertising revenue, right? That's between the influencer and the brand.
And there you have it.
So they've got no...
They've got nothing to lose.
Interesting. Okay, so it'll be whether or not the brand step up and do something, which they won't because there are many of them rather than, okay, well, we've identified a problem without a solution. Thanks
we
for
have.
That. Maybe we get Mark Zuckerberg on that because he seems to own every social media platform or the tops, right?
Just about, yeah.
Tell me about that.
So the list of the top 5 social media apps, not sites, apps was just released, and Facebook owns 4 of the top 5.
And so Facebook, obviously, right? Then
so
WhatsApp?
Facebook, WhatsApp, Messenger, WeChat, and Instagram. And WeChat is the only top app not owned by Facebook.
And so what does he do with all that power?
Converts it to money and buys mansions on the West Coast.
Right. I'm just looking. So Messenger came out of Facebook, essentially, right?
Right.
It's a little more independent now.
Right.
WhatsApp is pretty independent.
Yeah, it was bought separately. And then same with Instagram, where it was purchased by Facebook.
And so he just owns the media world.
Yeah. And maybe we'll see if he buys WeChat soon to kind of complete that top 5.
Which is Chinese, I think, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Well, he doesn't own Twitter. I was surprised. Twitter's pretty far down there.
Yeah, it is. It was after Weibo and Qzone, which are two bigger over in Asia, but not quite so much here.
So Twitter's always trying to figure out a way to get better. And, well, let's talk a little bit about these dating services, because now I saw a story about how Twitter... Is it Twitter or another company starting a dating service, but you have to be verified in order to be part of it?
Yes. Twitter is starting Blue, which is an online dating service for its verified users.
So I'm a verified user.
You can access Twitter Blue then.
I'm not actually in the dating pool. But why would just because I have a lot of followers make me or why would someone else who got a lot of followers be more attractive to me or others than someone who doesn't? That doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, so Tinder Select exists, and this is Tinder's version of a select membership pool for celebrities and rich people, but it's very exclusive.
I see.
So Tinder Blue is kind of the same thing, but it's a little more transparent where, you know, Twitter Blue, where Twitter is saying, hey, you know, this is exclusive, but we're letting you know who is exclusive enough for this.
And speaking of Tinder, there's this new thing about posting your picture, a selfie with a tiger on Tinder, so much so that PETA's getting involved?
Yeah, tigersoftinder.com.
Well, I haven't been to that site yet. I don't know. Have you, Randy?
I have, actually. I checked it out a few hours ago, just before today's show.
Research, yeah.
For research, yes. But yeah.
Why are people taking selfies with tigers to get a date?
That's a very good question. I'm not sure if it's because everyone loves a tiger or if it makes you seem more, you know, fierce.
Because you can't post pictures of other things?
You can, but tigers are pretty cute. You know, if I saw that and I'd be swiping right just for the tiger, like, hey, you have a pet tiger. That's so cool. Oh, you don't. Never mind. On match.
Randy Schaefer, digital editor at Chicago Tribune. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you for having me.